Welcome to New Books in Sociology. I'm your host, Annie Sapukaya. New Books in Sociology is one of the many channels in the New Books Network, a volunteer-driven project where we interview authors about their new books in different fields. This gives listeners the opportunity to learn about new books and new ideas from the authors themselves, and will hopefully make everyone dash to the bookstore. Today I am going to talk to Michael Salter on his new book, Organized Sexual Abuse, published by Routledge in 2014. Salter is a lecturer in criminology at the University of Western Sydney in Australia. His research focuses on the connection between gendered violence, health and culture, and the significance of violence in the formation of culture and identity. In this book, he talks about his research on multi-perpetrator and multi-victim abuse, and the trouble victims have getting their stories heard and believed. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Annie.
So we're talking to you today about your book, Organized Sexual Abuse. To begin, could you tell us a little bit about your background and why you decided to write this book?
I'm a lecturer in criminology at the University of Western Sydney. My background's in public health, and I became concerned about the lack of evidence and the lack of research specifically on the issue of multi-perpetrator child sexual abuse. I grew up with somebody who'd survived organized abuse, and this is something that I write about in the book because in her early 20s, when we were both in our early 20s, when she was trying to access services to address her mental health needs, and she also had quite serious concerns about her physical safety, we were unable to find any real support for her. So that really prompted me to shift gears a little bit and to take, I suppose, my background in public health and start to look at the disjunction between the needs of survivors of organized abuse and what was available for them in terms of health and welfare services and also the police.
What do you kind of define as organized abuse as opposed to, I guess, disorganized abuse or, you know, abuse that isn't a multi-perpetrator?
It's interesting you bring it up. There is sort of a crossover between organized and disorganized abuse. There's a significant minority of sexual abuse survivors who have experienced sexual abuse by more than one person because they're in a vulnerable situation and they experience opportunistic abuse by different people who don't know one another. My concern was particularly in relation to people who'd experienced sexual abuse by multiple offenders who did know one another and who were acting in concert, because this adds an additional dimension of secrecy and conspiracy to the abuse. My working definition of organized abuse for the book was quite simple, that there were more than two adults acting in concert to abuse more than one child. And I ended up in the book not restricting this to childhood, but to include adults as victims of organized abuse because I spoke to a number of women in particular whose experience of organized abuse began in childhood, but it didn't end in childhood. They continued to be abused into adulthood by the same offenders as they had been when they were kids.
Wow. And so what kind of research did you do? You interviewed a number of people, correct? There's a lot of sort of excerpts and quotes in your book about people that you spoke to.
It was a combination of qualitative research. So I did life history interviews with adults that had experiences of organized abuse beginning in childhood. And these interviews would last anywhere between sort of 2 to 8 hours. Often this was the first time that people had had the opportunity to really tell the story of their life and talk about how they'd come to be the people they were today. And often that person, that trajectory was shaped by these early onset traumas beginning in childhood. I really aimed to situate that qualitative research within the existing epidemiological and quantitative data that we already have about sexual abuse, because we've got very good long-term cohort studies and also prevalence studies of sexual abuse, and they clearly show that a proportion of people reporting abuse in childhood are reporting multiple offenders, and they're also reporting other experiences commensurate with organised abuse, such as the manufacture of child abuse images, the collusion of male and female perpetrators in abuse. So these were all indicators that I could use to start to construct an empirical framework or an empirical context within which I could situate the qualitative research in order to really bring out some of the linkages between what my research participants were saying and what we already know from the available data.
You talk a lot about victims of organized abuse not being believed. And I found that interesting because you do hear a lot about abuse, but the kind of abuse that you describe is so outrageous that it almost sounds made up. You know, is that a common kind of problem that it's so larger than life that it seems like this can't possibly be happening?
I think there's a few issues there. I think, firstly, although as a society and a community and different communities can be very vocal in their concern about sexual abuse, the fact is that being disbelieved is the most common experience for any sexual abuse survivor. It's very, very rare that a victim has an experience of being validated and believed, because if they lived in that community, if they were in that context where disclosures of abuse and symptoms of abuse were being detected and understood for what they were, they would be much less vulnerable to abuse in the first place. The abuse may not ever have taken place. So there is this disjunction, but behind the tremendous amount of talk that we have about sexual abuse, there really is a mass of victims and survivors who are disbelieved and who are silenced and invalidated. This is a particular issue for organised abuse survivors because the abuse that they experience tends to be more severe. So that's true of any multi-perpetrator sexual or physical offence. The more offenders are involved, the more severe the abuse and the violence tends to be. We also see in organised abuse cases that offenders are quite premeditated in undermining the child's disclosures. So using drugs, using costumes, uniforms, often sometimes quite bizarre behaviour, so that if a 5- or 6-year-old was to disclose what was happening to them, the words that they would use would be easily misunderstood. And, you know, we had an organised abuse case come to light here in Australia quite recently in which two men had in effect purchased a child from Russia and then raised the child in the context of a pedophile ring. And these men actually engaged in fake forensic interviews with the child. So they would pretend to be investigators and they would actually interview the child and coach the child on what the child should say, so that if the child ever was interviewed by police, they would be quite practiced in their responses. So this is the level of premeditation that we see in organised abuse, and it makes the community really uncomfortable to realise that there are a group of offenders that are very creative in their efforts to evade detection.
It seems like they have it all kind of figured out before. Like there's so much manipulation that it's almost impossible for them to even be believed, for victims to.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah. I think very difficult for survivors to tell fact from fiction. And that was something that comes up really consistently for anyone working in the organized abuse space, is that you're often speaking to adults or indeed speaking to children who have been told particular things about the nature of their abuse. So, for example, there was a case a few years ago in Wales where a group of people had come together and had engaged in ritualistic sexual abuse of children, and they were convicted and went to prison for this. But they told the children that they ran the world. They told the children that they had special, you know, magical assassins that would hunt the children down if they ever left. And, you know, it's a really interesting case because when you're working, you know, that's quite a well-substantiated criminal investigation with evidence and prosecution. But very often when you're speaking to adult survivors of organized abuse, they, you know, they may still believe this. They may still believe that their abusers are part of the government, that their abusers have special assassins that are going to hunt them down. So, and it's quite a fine line between trying to understand how they came to that worldview without necessarily believing it to be fact, but also without then invalidating them and undermining their understanding of what they've been through. It's a really difficult line to walk because survivors are so used to being disbelieved and very sensitive to feeling as though they're being laughed at.
And how does shame play into all of this? Because according to a lot of the examples that you give, perpetrators will often twist things so that they'll make it seem like it's the child's fault, or even with adults, right? They'll make them believe that, well, they somehow caused it in some way. And you hear that in terms of a lot of different kinds of abuse, but it seems to be very prevalent here.
Particularly for these really serious and sadistic forms of abuses, I think, you know, when I was doing the interviews with survivors, I really came to the sense that I think perpetrators believe it. I think that the perpetrators of the kind of abuse they were describing, in which the child was being forced to do extremely humiliating and degrading things, I think it's part of the worldview that perpetrators are trying to construct in order to exculpate their own responsibility for the abuse, that they create a situation in which the child is seen as really degraded and filthy and disgusting and therefore deserving of the things that the perpetrator group wants to do to the child. So the victim becomes locked into this sort of universe in which they feel very, very deeply dehumanized, and that's something that is ingrained in them from a very early age. And it's a lot of work for adult survivors to try and overcome this. And it's incredibly destructive. I mean, obviously, it's incredibly destructive thing to do. It is a real task, I think, for survivors of organized abuse to try and create a sense of themselves and a sense of their world in which they're able to get away from those deeply embodied feelings of shame and humiliation, which not only lock them into the cycle of abuse, but once they leave the abuse, really prevent them from disclosing because they don't want to talk about the things they've been forced to do.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience that you write about in the book about caring for your friend Sarah, and how that came about, and what happened to her through the course of your time together?
Sure. Sarah and I met when we were both in our late teens became friends over a period of time. And it was quite well recognized at the time in her friendship circle that, you know, she was troubled, that she had difficulties eating, she had difficulties sleeping, and often had nightmares at night. I became aware that she was actually leaving at night and was often not home at night, and was going on these quite long walks. And at a certain point, I insisted on coming along with her on one of these walks and said to her that I felt that she had some sort of traumatic experience in her background, that she may have been abused. And so we sort of started developing a rapport over time, and it was something that she was very cautious about. I think she had a lot of reasons to try and keep things secret. But it became pretty clear to me that she was still being abused, that something was still happening in her life. And that was something that she slowly let me know. And we made a decision together to work together to try and bring that abuse to an end. I really had no background in abuse. I had no background in trauma, no background in mental health. But I certainly came to feel that she was a suicide risk and that, you know, somebody needed to do something. So we spent about a year where we lived together and sort of tried to plan out, you know, how we were going to improve her mental health, how we were going to improve her physical well-being, how we were going to protect her from what was happening, because she was receiving phone calls, emails, text messages on her cell phone from these unidentified people who were instructing her to go to a certain place at a certain time, and they would sort of pick her up. So it was a really difficult, really horrifying year. I hadn't sort of seen any evidence of the abuse until then. She talked about it a little bit, but it was only once we lived together that I sort of saw really incontrovertible physical evidence that she was continuing to experience physical and sexual assault. And I write a little bit about this in the book. The offenders not only were calling the house and I would sort of pick up the phone and they would be on the end of the phone, but they also sort of broke into the house. And I write about an incident where they actually painted our house in blood. So we came home and they'd actually painted blood on the walls and left sort of animal organs in our bed and all sorts of things. It was crazy. We were in contact with the police and in contact with hospitals at the time. And flat out they didn't believe us. And it became quite a serious situation because particularly the hospitals, it became necessary to take Sarah to the emergency department a couple of times when she had quite serious physical injuries. And the hospital developed the view that we were colluding in this. This was some kind of make-believe scenario and that we were sort of doing this for attention. And so we actually had to stop using the hospital and stop contacting police as well and do what we could between ourselves in order to protect Sarah. So what sort of happened over the course of the year was, despite this pretty horrific sort of set of situations, you know, Sarah was very, very determined to leave the abusive group. She was very determined to find a different life for herself. And she was able to enroll in mental health treatment for trauma survivors. She really stuck with it. It helped her being able to eat. She was really underweight, so she was able to eat. She was able to sleep. And once she had that kind of physical well-being, that, of course, was very protective for her mental health as well. And she started making plans for a better life, a different life than the one that she had. Incredibly sort of courageous, very resourceful, very intelligent. And once she had those plans in place, she moved cities. So she moved away to a different place with the hope of making a new life for herself. And that's something that she's done very, very successfully, actually. It hasn't always been easy. Of course, she still has the mental health ramifications of what was done to her, and she's going to have to live with that for the rest of her life and manage that for the rest of her life. But I'm really happy to say that she's really happy, and she's got, you know, a family now, and she's got a job that she loves, and she's really happy. So it's a really good news story, and it's one that I wanted to write because I wanted people to know what we've been through and what the two of us had achieved working together. But also it's really important that survivors understand that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that if you put the work in and if you persevere, you know, you can find a life worth living. And that's a realistic goal for everyone that's been through what Sarah's been through.
So did you ever find out, like, who these people were? Were they people that she knew, like, in childhood, who had started abusing her as a child and then continued to harass her and stalk her?
Yeah, that's right. So there was certainly a childhood connection. I suppose what I was very shocked by was that, it was the persistence of the abuse. These men were clearly very, very concerned that child victims would grow to adulthood and would be reporting the abuse to the authorities. And that was explicitly, and that they said that, that is why they continued the campaign of abuse. They would actively encourage Sarah to kill herself. They really just wanted her out of the way because they were concerned that she would report the abuse to someone that would believe her. And she certainly knew of other victims who aren't here anymore because they had chosen to kill themselves. So she was, really, really holding on to her life and her sanity. And there was a tremendous amount of pressure being brought to bear to make her life so intolerable that that she would kill herself.
Wow, that's really horrifying. Could you tell us a little bit about the false memory movement, which is the something that, I mean, I remember hearing a lot about as a child, that there were all these TV shows and stuff where kids would, I think it was Law and Order, where, you know, kids would say they were abused and then they would say, oh, no, actually it was a false memory and this kind of thing. But you say this is actually a movement and that it really harms victims who have actually been abused.
In the 1980s, we saw a number of social and political movements develop around people who'd been accused of sexual abuse. The status of sexual abuse testimony in the criminal justice system has been very controversial and remains so today because historically in the criminal justice system, the status of women and children's testimony has been very uncertain. We have long-standing beliefs in our culture, in Western culture, that children can't tell fact from fiction, and we have long-standing beliefs in Western culture that women make up lies about sexual abuse and rape for attention, and women make up lies about sexual abuse and rape because women are childlike and are unable to differentiate between fact and fiction. We've explicitly articulated that in legal, you know, documents and legal texts well into the 20th century. So in the 80s, when both children and women began to disclose sexual abuse and this began to be taken seriously for the first time, you know, political movements and social movements were able to capitalize on this very pejorative negative view of women and children's testimony in order to garner a lot of support, and particularly a lot of support amongst journalists and media. And the news media has long been very skeptical of allegations of sexual violence, and they were also able to garner a lot of support from academics who were also, you know, socialized into this skeptical view. And that really came together in the early 90s in the United States, when a group of people accused of sexual abuse and their supporters were able to join together with a group of academics into a very powerful coalition of people who were arguing that much or most sexual abuse allegations were invented. And they drew particularly on a particular school of experimental psychological research that shows that adults and children who go through in a psychological laboratory, who go through a series of experiments or tests, may remember poorly a list of words, for example, or in a psychological experiment may become confused about particular details of their past and their history. So this was then generalized to sexual abuse allegations, particularly to characterize psychotherapy as a coercive environment. So the suggestion of the false memory syndrome was that a psychological experiment where someone is placed under pressure to think about or recall an event from their childhood that didn't take place, that this was commensurate or consonant with therapy, with the inference that therapy is a place where people are placed under pressure to remember things that didn't happen to them. So simply put, this was a false analogy. It was an overgeneralization of psychological research findings. And what we had happened, particularly in the United States, was a group of both psychologists and sociologists who began to make a lot of money as expert defense witnesses in the criminal justice system, charging $300 or $400 an hour for their testimony in defense of adults accused of sexual abuse. And not infrequently, adults accused of organized abuse, sadistic abuse, abuse that the community was already very skeptical of. So this really came together in the mid-90s as a tremendous social and political force that was pushing back at a lot of the gains that had been made in relation to the sexual abuse survivor movement. I think it was very successful, and in part because therapeutic treatment of sexual abuse survivors was in its infancy. People in mental health professionals, in their efforts to treat sexual abuse survivors, they weren't always doing a good job. They were making mistakes. It's possible that they were that there was a fringe group, I think, of mental health practitioners for whom sexual abuse was the origin of many or most mental illness. And it was just very unclear during this period. Most mental health practitioners were doing their best to develop evidence-based practice, but without a firm evidence base, that was very easy to undermine and mischaracterize in the media. And many journalists, I think many academics, were happy to do this. And my view is that there was a very strong gendered undertone to this, that these mischaracterizations of sexual abuse testimony as evidence of false memories, this mischaracterization of mental health practice as so-called recovered memory therapy, was an underhanded way in which people who were very hostile, I think, particularly to the women's movement and to the gains made by feminism, it was an underhanded way for them to mischaracterize the feminist movement and mischaracterize the support structures that the women's movement had put in place in order to protect not just survivors of sexual abuse, but to protect victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. Now, over the last 15 years, what we've seen is a consolidation of the evidence base for mental health practice. We've seen real consensus emerging around appropriate ways to treat sexual abuse survivors, and also what is the role of sexual abuse memories in treatment and in therapy. And a real push towards focusing on survivors' current capacities, focusing on building their skills in the present day. And that may involve talking about where they've been and what's happened to them, but less of a focus on sort of dredging up and trying to recall the details of early childhood. I think that that's a really healthy development. But we still have some questions around the access of sexual abuse survivors to the justice system. And how can we make sure that when sexual abuse survivors are reporting this abuse, that they have access to justice? Everyone that's been a victim of crime has the right to go to the criminal justice system. They should be treated well. They should be treated respectfully, and they should expect a just outcome. And that's an open question at the moment for people who choose to go to the police to report something that's really terrible that's happened to them when they were 5 or they were 10. I think we still have some way to go to make sure that sexual abuse survivors are having a good experience in the justice system and they're not being harmed by it.
It must be quite terrifying, because if they go to the police, then they need to tell the police, and if they prosecute, they need to tell their story again and again and again in court, right? And oftentimes they'll be in the same room as the person they're accusing.
It's very challenging, and it's difficult to strike a balance on both sides. You know, due process is really important, and there are just some practical obstacles for people who are recalling abuse that occurred 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. There's practical obstacles to proving that took place, and we're never going to escape from that conundrum. And sometimes it may mean that mental health practitioners and other support services need to be providing sexual abuse survivors with ways of accepting a really difficult fact, which is that they may not get their day in court, and they may really want that, and they may have every right to it, but there's only so much that we can prove or establish, to a reasonable, beyond a reasonable doubt, when a lot of time has elapsed. But nonetheless, those who choose to go to court and they've got a good case, they should be listened to. And the false memory argument, the notion of a false memory syndrome, has faded over time because it was never a scientific diagnosis. It never received mainstream acceptance in psychological science. And so we're in a good position now where some of those countervailing politicized forces that had really unjustly and without basis had sort of infiltrated the criminal justice system. They have lost their veracity and their credibility. But we do need to continue to reflect on how the justice system can adapt to the needs of vulnerable and easily intimidated witnesses.
Speaking about diagnosis, you talk a little bit about some of the coping mechanisms that sexual abuse victims use to kind of survive. And one of them is quite a controversial one, that of multiple personalities. What is your take on that diagnosis? Do you believe that it's real? And is the skepticism toward that diagnosis part of the false memory movement? Is it part of that attempt to, undermine the testimony of women?
Yeah, it's a really complex question, I think. People who have survived early trauma, severe trauma, particularly chronic abuse as they grow to adulthood, when they present in a mental health setting, they often have a very florid presentation. So the way in which they're presenting, they have much higher rates of psychotic symptoms, much higher rates of dissociative symptoms. They may be presenting in ways that are really challenging for a mental health practitioner to make sense of. Dissociative identity disorder, which is the way in which we now term multiple personality disorder, has been the subject of ongoing controversy really over the last 30 years, specifically because it is a common diagnosis for people who are recounting early and extreme trauma. So we can't make a distinction between the skepticism with which their stories and their testimony have been met and the skepticism that the diagnosis has attracted. Now, ironically, because of this skepticism, dissociative identity disorder, or DID, is one of the most well-substantiated psychiatric diagnoses in the DSM. We've got a range of different studies, including, MRI scans, brain scans, a range of different studies that clearly shows that there are significant differences in brain function and neurological function amongst adults who have survived serious and organized abuse. There's also been a lot of work done to show in research that adults with DID diagnoses, that their histories of organized abuse can be substantiated. And it's not uncommon that they have witnessed murder, for example, and that murder was investigated by the police and someone went to prison. That's quite common in the histories of people with DID. And the stereotype or the straw man of the woman with DID who's recounting this terrible history, and there's no documentation of it, that's simply false. When we look at psychiatric clinical case reviews, adults who have diagnoses of DID very often have very well documented histories of abuse. So DID is a psychiatric diagnosis that we can take seriously, and we need to take seriously because adults with a diagnosis of DID have really high physical and mental health needs, really high rates of psychosocial difficulty. There's no question that they have extremely difficult lives. And I think, unfortunately, the controversy over their diagnosis has overshadowed the fact that they're often too disabled to work, too disabled to carry on caring for their families sometimes, too disabled to enter into safe, productive relationships with other people. And it's really sad that this sort of false and I think exaggerated skepticism around the disorder overshadows their day-to-day needs.
You have a chapter called Living in Two Worlds, which is one of the more horrifying ones I find, because it talks about sexual abuse, organized sexual abuse within the family. And the thing that really struck me is how most of these families seem very normal, right? I mean, it's this facade of being having a daytime life and a nighttime life. Can you talk about how family organized abuse is maybe differs from other types of organized abuse?
So it's become clear in sexual abuse research that we have a very small group of families in which physical and sexual abuse is normal in the context of the family. So there's physical and sexual violence intergenerationally between adults and children and often between multiple levels of the generations in the family. But then sexual and physical violence is then normal across the family, so normal between siblings, for example. And these families tend to take two forms. There's either an extremely sort of disorganized, dysfunctional family, and this goes back to what you described earlier about disorganized abuse, where the family is just openly dysfunctional and violent and abusive. And these are the families that are much more likely to come to the attention of the authorities. We've had really horrific cases of this here in Australia recently, in which a family was discovered living in a rural property with multiple generations of incest going back not just to the grandparents but to the great-grandparents. And the family just lived in this openly dysfunctional kind of fashion, and the children have now been removed from that family. It's an extremely, very, very upsetting case. But because of the open dysfunction of the family, they're more likely to be identified. We then have these much more authoritarian, patriarchal families that is organized around the disavowal of the abuse. So although abuse and violence is happening routinely, normatively within the family, the structure of the family is organized to deny that the abuse is taking place, to disavow it, and to cover it up. And so this was a real focus for me, because a number of my research participants actually came from middle-class backgrounds. They came from upper-middle-class backgrounds. Their fathers were employed in quite well-paying jobs. Their mother was normally at home looking after the kids, as it were. The father controlled the income. He controlled the access of the family to healthcare. He controlled the communication that the family had to anybody outside of the family. And there was a tremendous amount of fear in the family about what would happen if you ever spoke out, not just because the father would be violent or the father was frightening, but also that the father was connected to a set of other men who also had the capacity to abuse and to be physically violent to the members of the family. So this particular chapter is called Living in Two Worlds because that's how participants described it. A number of participants who didn't know one another, they'd never met, they talked about having a day life and a night life. And they said what happened in my family during the day bore no relationship to what happened at night. It was completely different. And you didn't speak about what happened at night during the day. Nobody spoke about it. And if they spoke about it during the day, their family members would look at them as though they were crazy, and they would be told, "Oh, you just had a bad dream, you just had a nightmare last night. You're fine, everything's fine." So particularly as children, this was really powerful, a number of women, particularly, grew to adulthood believing that they just had bad dreams. And one woman who in the research I called Annie, this was incredibly sad because it was only when Annie's child began telling her about what Annie's parents were doing to their grandchild, and she, what he was describing were the things that she thought she had nightmares about as a child, because her parents always said to her, you're just dreaming. this is just a dream. And when her own son was saying to her very specific things that she remembered her father doing, it was then that she realized that she wasn't having nightmares, that she'd grown up in a very abusive family and then had then placed her own child at risk by leaving her child with her parents. So these are very effective strategies that, that families use in order to confuse children, in order to control children, and in order to quarantine the abuse in such a way that the child may, for many years, not ever get to a point where they're certain enough about what they're experiencing to tell anybody about what they're going through.
Most of the time, these perpetrators are men, correct, when it comes to sexual abuse?
Yeah, organized abuse is a really challenging one because it's one of the main domains or arenas in which we do see female offenders, we see female perpetrators of sexual abuse. And, you know, studies done in the US where in the United States where there is the FBI does actually have a database of sexual abuse incidents and offenders. Organized abuse is about 50% of the cases of female perpetrated sexual abuse. So it was really important in this study to look at the dynamics of organized abuse because it became quite clear from what participants were saying, and this is consonant with the research on female perpetrators of sexual abuse in treatment, that although women do participate in organized abuse and may take an active role in sexually abusing children, we need to look at the gender dynamics of the perpetrator group and recognize that very often this woman is not acting, as it were, freely, that there are, you know, she lives under the threat of violence. She's often also experiencing abuse alongside the children. So I tried to walk, I tried to walk a fine line in the book between recognizing that certainly women do engage in sexual abuse in the context of organized abuse, but also looking at often the limitations placed around them and their own lack of options and alternatives to leave the abuse or to protect their children.
You actually say that a lot of the time organized sexual abuse is a collective masculine performance. What do you mean by that?
Multi-perpetrator sexual offences are driven they're driven wholly by men and a particular male dynamic. That's true of gang rape. It is extremely rare, almost to the point where we've just never had a case of gang rape that has been female perpetrated and female driven. And so it's unsurprising that that's also a dynamic that's reflected in the context of organized abuse. And I was interested in this study in looking at the way in which the particular gender dynamics of perpetrator groups involve men performing a particular kind of masculinity, men using the bodies of children and women as objects through which they create particular masculine identities, and they perform those identities often in an audience of men, or we see women and children's bodies being used as objects of exchange. So men exchanging children with one another in order to perpetuate their bonds with one another, to establish status, prestige, sometimes for money, for payment. But it's clear that profit is not a real motivator in organized abuse. And that's true even when we look at internet-perpetrated organized abuse. It's pretty rare that anybody's really making any money from this. What they're doing is connecting with like-minded men, developing relationships with like-minded men, using the bodies of women and children, and from that, understanding themselves as a man in a particular kind of way. And in organized abuse, this construction of masculinity becomes very aggressive, very sadistic, really very, very dangerous kinds of masculinity being performed and perpetrated through sexual abuse.
What What do you hope that people will take away from your book, reading it? Like, what is your hope for the future?
I suppose it has the book operates for me on a couple of registers. There are a group of mental health practitioners who are already working with survivors of organized abuse. We have got some, I think, really useful, guides for treatment for organized abuse survivors, for survivors of extreme abuse. I think we've done some good work over the last 15 or 20 years to put in place a mental health treatment that's really supportive and really effective, and that's fantastic. What we don't have is the kind of sociological and criminological backdrop to that that makes sense of what organized abuse survivors have been through. Mental health practitioners are dealing with survivors one-on-one, and certainly in my experience is that mental health practitioners are often trying to develop an explanation for organized abuse, and my hope is that we can use in this book sociological theory, criminological theory, to start to paint a broader picture. And then this connects organized abuse with other efforts around sexual abuse, around domestic violence, around sexual assault. You know, organized abuse is on a continuum of sexual violence. This is how Liz Kelly in the UK describes it, a continuum of sexual violence. It's at the far end, but it's not off there in space on a peninsula, on an island, separate or distinct from other sexual offences. So organised abuse tells us something about our society. The fact that some children and some women are vulnerable to extreme abuse and extreme trauma over a long period of time, the fact that those women and children can repeatedly notify the authorities, can repeatedly notify the police, and yet not get support, not get assistance, it became really clear in my research that that's something that perpetrator groups take for granted. They expect the helplessness of the women and the children that they victimise. And it's only until, social services, welfare services, law enforcement, the criminal justice system makes the adjustments that they need to make in order to acknowledge that we have people who have survived extreme long-term trauma. It's only once they make those adjustments that we won't have organised abuse anymore. And so my hope is that the book is a resource for practitioners, but I hope it's also a resource for those sociologists, those criminologists, those policymakers who are thinking long term about how we can realign our policy settings, how we can realign our provision of services in order to address the burden of violence on us as a community, because it's really clear that survivors of organized abuse are actually a very, very expensive population for us as a community. They're making repeat contacts with police, with health services, alcohol and drug services, social services. We see a tremendous overrepresentation of organized abuse survivors on the streets. So they're falling so far through the cracks. They're on the streets. They're in prison. We have too many organized abuse survivors in prison. We have too many organized abuse survivors in the acute psychiatric system because they're just not getting the support that they need. So we can't afford this. We can't afford to ignore the burden of abuse and violence. It's a financial burden, but it's a tremendous human cost. And I think that the book seeks to really make that concrete and really drive that home.
If people want more information about the book, the research that you did, and sexual abuse in general, where can they find it? Is your book readily available? Is it out now in print or on Amazon?
So you can order the book through Amazon. You'll find it in a range of online booksellers. It's actually just been released in paperback, which is great because it makes it quite affordable. So the book's been released this month in paperback. And I certainly hope that'll make it affordable for practitioners, for policymakers, but also for survivors of organized abuse and sexual abuse who feel that they're ready to start to read more broadly about what they've been through.
Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about your book.
Thanks, Annie. I really appreciate it.
have been listening to an interview with Michael Salter, author of Organized Sexual Abuse. This is your host, Annie Sapukaya. Thank you for listening to New Books in Sociology.